Hello everyone, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. This is Stefan Sasse. I am one of your two illustrious hosts this evening, and I am known for essays on the Tower of the Hand and for my own blog, The Nerdstream Era, which you can find at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And with me is, as always,
is Sean T. Collins. I'm a television critic for various publications, including Rolling Stone, which is primarily where I cover Game of Thrones. I'm the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones blog located at boiledleather.com. And I am the co-author with series editor Ann Grohl and A World of Ice and Fire and Westeros.org's Elio Garcia Jr. of the official annotated Game of Thrones for the subtext.com iPad app. And today we are doing something a little different and a little unusual, and I'm not entirely sure how it's going to work. But you're going to go on this journey with us, and I hope you like it. I guess that's a weird way to describe what we're about to talk about.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Oh, I hope you have a great time listening to us talk about Nazi Germany.
Okay, and just as a disclaimer for everyone, if you didn't know it already and heard it from the accent, I am German, so this is also kind of a weird topic for me as well, originating in the country. So let's see where this will take us. And just so you know, why the hell are we talking about this? There are several reasons. One of it has to do with Martin himself, because we have often talked about that we think that A Song of Ice and Fire is something of an anti-war book. But Martin, in interviews, for example, with the Rolling Stone, has always said that he is not a fully committed pacifist and that he would have fought in World War II, but he didn't want to fight in Vietnam. So for us, of course, the interesting thing to look at is, what is it about World War II that fascinates Martin in a way that he says, this is a war that is worth going into, while Vietnam or Iraq or what have you is not? So that's one of the questions we want to explore. And the second one is kind of a contemporary thing, because in the ongoing pre-primary elections, Dr. Ben Carson has made some remarks that have brought a discussion about Nazi history to the front and center, so to speak.
Which is just shocking to me, I have to say. I finished reading Ian Kershaw's two-volume biography of Hitler, subtitled Hubris and Nemesis, I think 2 days or 1 day before Ben Carson began talking about how if the Jews had been armed a la people in America with the, you know, Second Amendment rights, allegedly, to bear arms, the Holocaust would have been prevented. And the level of ahistoricity in the statement was so shocking to me. And I think shocking to a great many people in America, to our collective credit, I suppose.
Not only in America.
What'd you say?
Not only in America.
Yeah, well, of course, not only in America, of course. And to me, this is important, because I've said this in many contexts. I think it's beyond, it's unspeakably grotesque to repurpose actual historical atrocities to suit your pre-existing politics and then kind of pat yourself on the back like, well, I would never have, you know, fallen victim to that or participated in that or whatever the case may be. It's you know, you're talking about real people, in this case tens of millions of real people who died and suffered horribly, to make a point about, you know, to kind of shore up your own political credentials. It really upsets me. I just think it does a tremendous disservice to the dead, and so this seemed like a topic worth talking about. It's something, as you can hear from, I think, both of us, something that we've both been interested in our lives as readers and writers and thinkers. And I think given the shape of our interest in A Song of Ice and Fire, it could be, well, we're hoping it'll be a worthwhile subject to address on, in the context of this podcast. So here we go.
Yes, definitely. Yeah. So I just wanted to start this whole topic with a little bit of factual background, especially in regards to weapons in Germany and what role they played, because Ben Carson is factually wrong in the idea that there were no weapons in Germany in private possession back at the time. One of the major problems was that there were weapons in private possession, only the Nazi thugs were the ones wielding them. So there was an incredible level of political violence going on in the early 1930s. And this political violence was abhorrent to pretty much every law-abiding citizen. So the Nazis basically created a big problem, the political violence on the street, that no one was able to solve. At the height of the movement, the Nazi thugs, the Sturmabteilung, the SA, was about 1 million strong. And that at a time when the German army was 100,000 strong. So they were basically a shadow army. And they ruled the streets in terms of violence. And everyone wanted this to stop. And there was this weird situation in which the Nazis were the only ones who were attributed with the power to stop it. That's what they actually were campaigning on. You know, elect us and all this chaos will stop and we will bring law and order back. They obviously didn't say that they were the ones creating the chaos, but that was a very viable strategy back at the time. So if the Jews would have had guns and acted as a monolithic unit, which they weren't, by the way, but if they would have if they would have fought back, then they would have made all this chaos and political violence even more outrageous, and they wouldn't have inspired the German people but brought them up all against them. So this would have been really the most stupid idea that anyone could have had back at the time.
Because it's not as if the arms held by communist militias and, you know, just sort of street fighters were able to stop the Nazis either. You know,
no, not at
that's
all.
That's who these fights were with. They were with armed political opponents, and you saw what good that did them. And, you know, and this, of course, none of this speaks at all to the situation in all the countries that the Nazis conquered and all the countries where the Holocaust was perpetrated that weren't Germany. You know, German, you know, the state of personal, you know, what weapons were in whose hands in Germany, you know, has fuck all to do with what was going on in Poland or Austria or Czechoslovakia or France or Belgium or the fucking Soviet Union, which is where the Holocaust really took off. You know,
yes.
The Nazi gun regulations, to the extent that that was an issue, did not apply to villages in the Ukraine, you know?
No.
So, like, the whole thing is so preposterous. And oh boy, oh boy. This is going to be another angry Sean episode, I can tell.
It is also interesting from the, how do you say, virtual history standpoint of it, because it always poses this question, what would you have done? You know, I would have rushed the shooter style.
Right, oh and, yeah.
Yeah, and obviously, you try to emphasize with the what would I have done if I had been Jewish? You know, would I have resisted, knowing full well that certain death awaited me anyhow? You know, this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. In Germany, the question is a little bit different. Obviously, the main counterfactual that we always have to face is: would we have helped in the Holocaust? Or would we have been good Nazis, or would we have tried to resist? There were German resistors, obviously. Tom Cruise immortalized one of them, but they were few and far between.
Right.
So this is one of the questions that is always running in an undercurrent, and which I encounter in classrooms oftentimes, when people can't really understand why everyone went along, and then you always get this, I wouldn't have, and I'm always, sure you would.
Right. Right.
Almost everyone would have.
I think that's... I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm pretty much finished.
I just think that's so important to keep in mind. I think if you look at history with your default assumption being that you personally would have been just as bad as everybody else, you get a whole lot more out of history than because then you're capable of learning. If you look at it thinking to yourself, well, this doesn't apply to me, I got this all figured out, I know the right thing to do, then you're not actually capable of learning anything from history. It's only adopting a point of view where you go in thinking like, listen, I'm just as much of a know-nothing fuck-up as all these people. You know, what did they do wrong? You know, what would I have done wrong? What would have been a better thing to do? Why did it happen? You know, you kind of have to put yourself in the shoes of the perpetrator, or at least, you know, just not stepping back from your 2020 hindsight vantage point in the here and now.
I don't even need to shake my 2020 hindsight. I'm pretty sure that if you take me as I am now, with all what I know now to be right, with my value system intact, and put me in a time machine and threw me back there, I would still basically go along, because the alternative comes at such a high personal price,
right,
that only really heroes, you have to say, are able to withstand the kind of social pressure, at least, you are facing if you are trying to resist such a regime. And, I mean, it was really dangerous. The concentration camps were first invented for Germans, not for foreigners. The first inmates were political prisoners. And everyone knew this. So to be a hero in these kind of circumstances takes a level of personal, I don't know how to say this, a stalwartness?
Yeah.
That I am pretty sure I don't have.
There was a beautiful, beautiful passage in the second volume of Kershaw's Hitler biography, which is officially titled Hitler 1936 to 1945 Nemesis. And Kershaw wrote with really self-evident passion and admiration about the Stauffenberg plot, which was, as Stefan noted, you know, that army officer was played by Tom Cruise in a movie, I think it was called Valkyrie.
Yes.
And it was the closest that anybody came during the war to assassinating Hitler. And in the chapter, which is quite long, about the build up to the plot and the fallout from the plot, there's a really marvelous passage describing what it was like for any of these people to participate in this plot. I'll quote it. He said, "Nor was it just the constant dangers of discovery and physical risks that acted as a deterrent. There was also the isolation of resistance.
Yes.
To enter into, even to flirt with, the conspiracy against Hitler meant acknowledging an inner distance from friends, colleagues, comrades, entry into a twilight world of immense peril, and of social, ideological, even moral isolation. That's a thing to consider here. Nobody agreed with them, as far as they knew. You know,
yes.
Most people were going along to get along, and that was true. That was true when the Soviets were like a football field away from the fucking bunker in 1945, and everything lay in ruins. Still no one was willing to rot the boat to any great extent. So for these people to decide, despite everything they've been taught and their entire adult lives about military honor and military virtue and treason and mutiny, to decide like, no, this guy, we have to do something. He's horrible. This is unacceptable. This will destroy our country, you know, to act was to cut yourself off. You didn't have, these guys didn't have the benefit of listening to this podcast to tell them that they did the right thing, you know?
Go ahead. Especially since they all had the example of the end of World War One in mind.
Yeah.
With this overbearing stab in the back legend, they knew that they would be traitors. Yeah? Even if they succeeded, practically the whole German people would see them as traitors, because their plan was, after all, killing Hitler, installing a government, and then capitulating. that would have been seen as treason to practically everyone except precious few. And so there was yet another dimension on top of all of this that made all these resistance groups so problematic. And what you just talked about, that even when the Russians stood 100 meters in front of the bunker in Berlin, that no one really stopped fighting.
Yeah.
This is one of the most interesting aspects about World War II, because World War II is a war that is very rare in that the population, in this case the Germans, fought really until the end. That is not something that happens often.
Yeah.
And basically when Stauffenberg made his assassination attempt in July 1944, only a month after the invasion of Normandy, the Germans were basically in the same position as when they threw the towel in World War I. There was no way this war could be won. It was simply over. And everyone knew it. The people knew it, or at least felt it. Mm-hmm. The military knew it for sure. And yet it would drag on for another year. And this is something incredible, and it is really hard to explain because so many factors are necessary for the Nazis to maintain control of the part of Germany they actually had control over until the very end, to do this in this way. You know, it is totally pointless. And all those big battles in which so many people died were totally pointless, and everyone knew it. It was just delaying the inevitable.
Right.
And this is, to get back to the Song of Ice and Fire universe for a moment, this is why I have such a strong reaction to the Blackfish in A Feast for Crows, because I'm always saying he's basically a war criminal when he refuses to give up River Run, because he is not in the same moral spot, but in the same military spot as many German commanders were in those closing months of 1945. When they were surrounded, there was no way they could win. And if they continued resistance, the only thing they achieved would be to kill people on both sides, but mainly on their own. And that is why I simply don't understand how his resistance can be seen as something inspiring or something good. I'm always just seeing King in the North is dead. Your liege lord stands in front of your own castle on the gallows. So there is no one you can fight for except your own honor. And everyone will die because of it. You have already killed many people because he threw them all out of the castle in order to be able to withstand a siege. And I don't get it. It's the same thing in which I don't get in the historical event. How do people do this? How can they do it? I simply don't understand it.
Yeah, you know, Hitler was fighting for an ideal more than he was fighting for a country or even a race or a people. You know, you saw as the fortunes of the war turned, Hitler had no more attachment to the lives of full-blooded Germans, quote-unquote, than he had to Jews or Slavs or any of the, you know, the hated racial groups that the Nazis, you know, ran amok among, or, you know, or even just, you know, the French or the English or whoever, because he was fighting for this sort of Germanic, heroic ideal, and to the extent that the war was not being won, that was because the people fighting it, the Germans, were not worthy of that ideal. They weren't holding up their end of the bargain. So yes, you're talking about a guy who never toured any bomb damage, who never met with injured troops, who barely appeared or even addressed the public for the final years of the war. I mean, that's really that was shocking to me when I first found out that you can count the number of public addresses Hitler made in the last, I think, 3 years of the war on two hands. I mean, that's crazy. Think about that.
Even by radio, not only public, even radio speeches.
He can make. You know, he would occasionally speak to the party bigwigs or the old fighters, but it's still like it's. That just blew my mind. because it wasn't about them. It wasn't about the public any more than, you know, as you say, the Blackfish turns out people so he can withstand, you know, so he can sustain a siege, because it wasn't about them. You know, it's about River Run. It's about the heroic spirit animating River Run, you know, which
what
is
an idea.
What'd you say?
More an idea.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And this also ties in again to this big topic that they have, especially in A Feast for Crows, because as you said, Hitler more or less vanished for the last 2 or 3 years of the war. He was basically invisible to the German people. So what do they fight for? Who do they fight for? And they turn to the next best thing. They can't give up. There are too many social and organizational controls on, so they can't simply give up, because most of them are fighting against the Russians and getting into captivity with the Soviet Union wasn't exactly an alternative, and everyone knew it, and the German propaganda really fired on this idea. It was always, you die either way. If you fight for us or if you give up, you're dead. And that was very effective.
Yeah, it's probably... I'm sorry to interrupt, but it's just extremely important to note that the Eastern Front was basically the worst thing that's ever happened to mankind, I would say. You know, the years-long exchange of horrendous war atrocities between, you know, probably the two worst people who've ever lived in Hitler and Stalin. You know, the German assault on the Soviet Union was barbaric, and then the Soviet counterattack on German-held territory, and then especially Germany itself, was also barbaric, you know, particularly with as regards to the treatment of women, where you're talking about, you know, a great, you know, more than one out of every four women were raped in some circumstances in the, you know, in the entire territory that they occupied. So, you know, some of this propaganda was barely even propaganda, you know, and that's to say nothing also, as you mentioned, of the prisoners of war who were basically just slaughtered in the millions. So it was, you know, that was in a way a valid reason to fight, just to save your own skin in a way.
Yes, and that of your own. One of the most powerful propaganda instruments was this thing: you don't fight for the Nazis, you don't fight for the for this idea in which you don't believe, and we don't care if you believe in it at that point of the war. But the thing is, if you stop fighting, the Russians will get your family.
Right, right.
It came down to this very simple thing, and this reminds me of the September Maribold speech, because all those soldiers in the wars, they don't care for that lord or this lord and stuff. What they care for is the man next to them, and perhaps this is a little bit dependent on where they are fighting and where they are from, trying to defend your own people. And the effective leaders and effective propagandists will always boil it down to this point, which you can see very well in this war.
Yeah. Now, I'm curious, do you think that there are groups that serve a comparable role to that of the Soviets in Nazi propaganda within A Song of Ice and Fire? Like, would you say, I don't know that it's come to this point yet, but do Euron Greyjoy and Victarion Greyjoy and the Ironborn represent that kind of existential almost threat, or the Dothraki, if that becomes a factor? Can that kind of level of fear be ginned up about certain groups in A Song of Ice and Fire?
I think they are trying it for a brief amount of time in A Clash of Kings, when they are trying to paint Stannis as this fanatic with a fire god and stuff. Yeah. But this never amounts to much, because the plot is too short. The time they have for it is too short. Right. When they start really ramping up the propaganda against Stannis, the war is half over. And then it's the assault on King's Landing, and from that point on, it doesn't matter anymore.
I just thought of something, since you mentioned A Clash of Kings. This is the Lannister position on Robb and the North. They're like werewolves, they're eating people, you know, that's the great, you know, the great northern menace must be stopped at all costs.
Yeah, at least a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if that's really comparable, because this propaganda is directed mainly against Rob,
right?
Trying to justify your own losses. So really, they were losing left and right, and they just needed some rationale, because in one day it was this young boy who couldn't tie his own shoes, and the next day they were taking all these losses. So they vilified Rob a little bit and attributed it to dark magic, which we can also see with Bloodraven and Darren II. But I don't see any evidence of Northern racism or racism targeted against Northerners in the books. There is a little bit of their backwater in something, but nothing on the level of the Untermenschen, the inferior humans that the Nazis had. On the other hand, what you can see between Stannis and the Lannisters is more evolving into that direction, although it's cut short by the Battle of King's Landing.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the Ironborn really generally do have a kind of supremacist viewpoint of themselves.
Yes.
And you've seen how that manifests, if the Ironborn, for some reason, by some accident of history, came out of the West or the Reach instead of the Iron Islands, like, then there would have been some real trouble. But fortunately, they just don't have the resources to back up the egomania. So they effectively have just like a culture of theft, and it's difficult for them to, at least in recent history, has been difficult for them to make good on any of their supremacist claims and beliefs. Although that, historically, I guess Harrenhal is the high watermark of Ironborn supremacy.
Yes, but I would be a little bit careful in comparing their ideology to the Nazi one, because it seems to me the Ironborn's supremacy is more in the terms of white supremacy, what you could find in the South, which is, while still evil, not the least comparable to the genocidal stream that you had in Nazi ideology. I think it doesn't go that far.
Yeah, and I also feel like there's just, as a general rule, I want to caution everyone listening and sort of slam the brakes on making too much of any kind of similarities or any
yes.
comparisons that we're drawing here, because, there's great debate among historians as to whether the term fascism can even apply to anything now. Like, outside the interwar years between World War I and World War II, there's a mainstream historical belief that, like, whatever you're talking about that may have fascist overtones is not fascism. Fascism was an artifact of a particular time and place. So if it doesn't apply now, it certainly doesn't apply to this imaginary medieval, feudal society that Martin dreamed up. I think we're drawing points of comparison mostly because it's morally illuminating, more than it's historically illuminating.
Absolutely.
So yeah, I don't want anyone to think that, like, that we're stupid.
No. Just to return to the very first point with which we introduced the topic in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
There is only one apt Nazi comparison in the whole saga, and this is the others. Because
yes.
The question with which we started was, what did Martin see in World War II that brought him, who is more or less a pacifist, to saying, this is a war I would have fought? And I think what we can find in The Song of Ice and Fire is that all those conflicts we have seen so far are not worth fighting. But the one against the others is definitely the one conflict, the one war you have to fight, which it is absolutely imperative that you do not compromise, that you do fight it out. And I think this is also the feeling that many people have towards World War II, especially in the United States. You know, it's the good war, where you are unapologetically the good guys. And this is really uncontested, and I don't know how familiar you are with this. In Germany, you will be hard-pressed to find anyone arguing that it was a bad thing that we lost the damn war.
Right.
So it couldn't be fast enough. There is, in fact, a more or less of a movement going on trying to redefine the conquest of Western Germany by the Allies as a liberation from the Nazis, which bears its own problems in itself.
Sure.
We didn't need really to be liberated because we were never conquered in the first place. We did this voluntarily. But this is really not something you will find here. No one will debate that it was a good war and that the Americans were on the good side. Even with all the bombing and the death and all that kind of stuff, you cannot argue that this is a war which should have been ended by a peace treaty or perhaps never been fought in the first place. This is a debate you will find in Britain, strangely enough, a little bit more in America when you're talking about Munich and appeasement and that stuff, but not in Germany.
You do see, you know, there is a fringe group of people on the right in America, most notably Pat Buchanan, who effectively take the position espoused at various times by leading figures in the Third Reich, up to and including Hitler, that the Western Allies should have joined forces with Germany against the Soviet Union and Bolshevism, rather than joining forces with Bolshevism against Nazi Germany. It's you know, every second that my precious, beautiful brain spends thinking about this argument is, I feel myself growing closer to the grave. I cannot wrap my mind around it, you know, beyond the fact that Pat Buchanan is an anti-Semite, which he is. I think you kind of have to often examine those sort of base assumptions about different swaths of humanity among people who think that, you know, our goals as Western civilization would have been better served taking the opposite side in that particular conflict. But yeah, I'm really, really glad that you brought up World War II in comparison to the others, because I've had, because I think that this can help us examine and understand how World War II has been used pedagogically in America, if not other places, to kind of inculcate certain values into young Americans. Now, I recently got a comment on the blog about something that you and I had done, you know, discussing, you know, A Song of Ice and Fire's and anti-war work, you know, saying, like, well, it's not really anti-war. I mean, Martin has said that he would have fought in World War II. And my response was that, you know, World War II is the exception that proves the rule. You know, we in America treat it the other way around. We're like, well, World War II was worth fighting, so therefore war can't possibly be bad. World War II was good. And, you know, there's the degree to which Americans treat every new enemy as like the new Hitler, you know, is laughable on its face, and I don't really think we need to waste a whole lot of time talking about that. The real issue for me is this. When we in America are taught about Munich in 1938, we're taught that appeasement was the moral failing of the Allies, and especially Neville Chamberlain, who is like the worst person in American political life to whom you can be compared. The worst. There's nobody worse. And
not even Hitler.
Not even Hitler. No, honestly. Because that Hitler becomes kind of self-refuting because you've got Godwin's Law and everyone's like, if you're comparing someone to Hitler, it's just obviously stupid. You sound like a crazy person. But you can compare people to Chamberlain all the time and you don't sound like a crazy person. It sounds like you're a serious moral thinker about right and wrong, and standing up for justice and standing up for the oppressed. What was actually going on at Munich is that everyone else in Europe was scared fucking shitless of serving another generation of its young people into a fucking meat grinder for no reason, which is what World War I was.
Yes.
You know, World War I was millions of people dying for fucking nothing. And almost everybody else in Europe was capable of seeing this, except for the Nazi Party, who saw World War I as a shameful capitulation on the part of Germany due to being stabbed in the back by Jewish financiers and socialists, which never really made any sense, by the way. You know, the Jews were equally responsible for, like, finance capitalism and Stalin, which is hilariously stupid, but unfortunately tens of millions of people were murdered for it. Anyway, it was Hitler's moral failing. Hitler was the person to get angry at Munich, because Hitler was lying. Because he didn't care. He didn't care if he brought all of Europe into war, you know, by taking more land after he promised, this is it. This is it for me. I promise, guys. I don't want anything else. This is it. I'm done. He's lying through his fucking teeth because he didn't care. You know, when the British said, you know, like, listen, okay, but if you do anything else, if you start going after Poland, if you do any, you know, we're going to go to war. I'm serious, man. I'm serious. And they were trying to avoid it because they were sane and they were humane. Yeah, they didn't want millions of people to die. Hitler did. And
definitely. He said to one of his subordinates after Munich that the next time he would make sure that, and I'm quoting here, that no asshole will ruin my war. He wanted to go over war with Czechoslovakia. And Neville Chamberlain robbed him of his war. That was how he saw it. He wanted to go, and the Munich Agreement basically made it impossible for him. But I think you are opening up a little bit of a too easy, a too easy rift between the Nazis on the one hand and the rest of Europe on the other. Because the fault line here about how you perceive World War I is more about the winners and losers section of it.
That's true, yes. Yeah.
So when World War I was over, the Germans had seemingly lost it, and the Allies, France and Britain, had seemingly won it. But throughout the 20s, it felt the other way around for the French and the British, because the Germans were getting stronger and stronger, the French and British were getting weaker and weaker, and it didn't seem like it had solved any of the problems that were then seen at the heart of the conflict. So for the French and the British, the consequence was, this war was a mistake, and we shall never wage war again. And for the Germans and the Hungarians and the Bulgarians and all the loser nations of the war, and the Italians, by the way, too, even though they were on the Allied side, the lesson to draw from World War I was the exact opposite. Yes, the war was a mistake because we didn't go the whole way through. And this is also something that I want to talk about. For the Germans, the main lesson from World War I was that they did it only half-heartedly. And the next time, it has to be total war. No regard for civil rights. No regard for the Geneva Convention. No regard for anything but victory. Everything has to be subordinated under the military rule, under the laws of war. And if we do that, then we will win. World War II was basically the reenactment of World War I. The idea, same war again, but this time we'll win. And if we do it right this time, then we will win. I guess it was the biggest counterfactual experiment that has ever been done on a historic subject with horrific consequences. But the one positive thing that came out of World War II is that this question was answered for at least the next 70 or 80 years to come. Because, no, it was not a question of the right tactic or the right strategy or of your pure will to resist. As the Nazis have constantly said, you know, if we would just have held out for another year or something, then we would have won. And World War II proved beyond a doubt that holding out doesn't help you. The country was utterly defeated. There was total capitulation, total annihilation of the German state, and rightly so. Which is, by the way, one of the really difficult moral questions, because I am glad that the Hitler assassins failed. If Stauffenberg would have won, Germany would be a really toxic place afterward. But since everyone could experience Hitler failing from the start to the very end, with no possibility for a total dictator to shirk responsibility, it was him and it was the Nazis. They had total power. They could do whatever they wanted, and they still fucked it up. So there can be no discussion about could they have won. No, they couldn't. Simply, there is no conceivable way. This question has been answered. But this idea that if you just win a final battle, one giant strategic feat, one master tactical stroke, then you will win, is a fantasy that is by no means consigned only to the fringes of society. Many people think that if you just wage the war in the right way, that you will win. You know, you can beat ISIS by doing whatever. You can beat whoever you want by just the right strategy or the right amount of willpower to do it. I mean, how many times have you read that Obama needs to really stand up and show some strength and leadership, and then everything will be all right?
Right.
It is not.
No, the answer is always more fighting, by the way. You know, the tough guys are never like, you know, if only we had not invaded that city or not dropped that bomb. And that, I think, is the thing that distresses me the most about how we're taught about World War II, which is World War II is used as a justification, effectively, for perpetual war, which I think is the opposite lesson that should be drawn from World War II. World War II is nothing more or less than what Stefan just described, the tragic consequences of believing that war was the answer. We just didn't phrase it in the right form. Like, we didn't phrase it in the form of the question. Like it's Jeopardy, you know? And like, oh, we're going to try it again this time. And this time we'll get it right. Well, no. And it's distressing to me that in America, at least, the Allies took effectively the lesson that Hitler took from World War I, which is that, no, war was the right thing to do. We just didn't do it right. You know, for us, it's like, well, we did it right this time, and we will do it right every other time, and it's always the right answer. You know, because if we had fought earlier, if Chamberlain had not given in at Munich, you know, none of this would have happened. And it's like, well, that may or may not be true. Obviously, it was not, in retrospect, the right thing to do. But that was because there was a contingent here that wanted war at any cost. And was going to get it, and did, and that's what happened. And I think that if you take from World War II the lesson that, like, war in some fundamental way is good, that's not what that war was about. That's not what that war. That war was a proof of the opposite.
Yes, you can't live in peace if your neighbor won't let you.
Yeah.
And this is something that happens, obviously, with the others, because you can reason with them. At Munich, with the others, is impossible, because they will never agree to it. They are more honest than Hitler in this instance, but they are just as evil. And by the way, to the argument that you made before of Hitler and Stalin, basically, there are two bad guys fighting it off. But I think that Hitler is still worse. So the argument that you should have allied with him to stop the Soviet Union, it's like allying with the devil to stop, I don't know, some ancient death god.
There's no Cold War possible with Hitler and Nazi Germany.
No.
That's what it comes down to. I mean, you see that time and again if you read about Hitler's life in any great detail. He was always thinking about, like, two wars ahead, you know?
Yes.
Like, he'd fucking talked about fighting the Japanese at one point. He was thinking about it. You know, he thought about a lot of things. But my point is that, like, he wasn't going to settle in to anything, ever, because life was struggle. That was his fundamental viewpoint. That's what life is. Life is fighting. Life is struggle. Life is the weak against the strong, and only the strong survive. And so it was never going to stop. You were never going to have 50 years of, like, little flare-ups in Asia and Africa and South America between, you know, fascist and, you know, democratic capitalist societies, you know, in the event that we had teamed up to destroy the Soviet Union. That was never going to happen. You know, 5 years later, 10 years later, we would have been at war with Nazi Germany. Again.
Yes.
That seems safe to say, right?
Yeah, pretty much. he definitely wouldn't have been content. If you are interested in this kind of factual, there's this Thomas Harris novel Fatherland, which talks about this Cold War situation in which the United States and victorious Nazi Germany stare each other down over the Atlantic, but only for the reason that no one has yet figured out how to attack the other. So I guess that's the best case scenario for such alliance, basically.
Right.
But I would like to take a leap back in history, so to speak, into the last, other way around, into the first years of 1930 to 1933. These are the death throw years of the Weimar Republic, when Hitler wasn't yet in power but was becoming a major factor. And at that time, democracy in Germany was clinically dead. It was only formally yet alive. And the German president at that time was a noble called Hindenburg. And this guy controlled more or less everything, but he himself was very old and most likely already pretty sick. I guess his brain was more or less mud at that point. So who ruled in truth was a cabal of nobles that surrounded him and that prodded him in every direction. And some of those guys argued for bringing Hitler to power, to use him. And I don't know, but this is something that reminds me very much of King's Landing and the court, and how various factions are trying to vie for control of a weak king and try to prod him in certain directions, and then some of them are allying themselves with a populist movement they only partially understand and quickly lose control of. So this sounds really like something that happened in A Song of Ice and Fire.
Yeah, I was like, I think I know where you're headed with this, Stefan.
I don't know if this was an inspiration for Martin, but the parallel is at least illuminating, because all this cajoling of power behind the scenes, which we see with Littlefinger, with Varys, and all the other guys, the Game of Thrones, basically, ultimately leads to nothing. But to the certain destruction, all of it will be rendered moot when our savior arrives. I mean, Dany with her dragons will most likely roast most of these guys, and the others will do for the rest.
Right.
So I think this is also one of the major lessons that we can draw both from history and from the books, I hope, that all this intriguing, this behind-the-scenes mechanizations, all that kind of stuff, is really bad.
Yeah, I mean, the great incorrect line of history from the comparable time period that you're talking about is von Papen, who's, you know, a sort of run-of-the-mill conservative reactionary politician who helped broker the deal that brought Hitler into the chancellorship. You know, his buddies are like, dude, you fucked up. Like, you've walked right into his trap or whatever. And he's like, no, you are mistaken. We've hired him. And, you know, which is such a wonderfully wrong pronouncement on history, but it's exactly, I'm sure, you know, that's Cersei thinking about the High Sparrow, you know?
Yeah, I hired him.
Yep.
And in 3 months, I will have him in the corner until he squeaks, which is also a von Papen citat, a quote which he said about Hitler. In 3 months' time, he will squeal in a corner. Yeah, in the effect, it was him.
Squealing. Oh, boy.
That's squealing.
So, and then, when you had talked about the essay earlier, and the situation of, who had the state did not have a monopoly on violence in the Hobbes,
no.
Description. And obviously something very similar is going on right now, in A Song of Ice and Fire, where you have the faith militant, I would say at the very least, a rival militarily to the existing state, and house-based military organizations.
No one knows how a military confrontation would look like, and as of yet, no one wants to risk it.
Right.
But this is in itself a problem if you are not sure if it comes if the situation comes to a head, whether your forces would prevail the city guard, all the soldiers among the armed rabble, then you have a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the situation in which the Weimar Republic in the early 30s found itself. And this is also a situation in which Hitler found himself, funny enough. After he came into power, he had this very strong 1 million armed thugs who were now legitimized. They were actually employed as, how do you call this, auxiliary sheriffs, and could pose as police while beating up their opponents. But those guys argued for a radical revolution, for completing the work they had done. And this was, of course, anathema to the conservatives on which power and support Hitler rested.
Yeah.
So what he did 1 year after coming in office was to instigate a mass murder of the upper echelons of his own organization, the famous Night of the Long Knives, the Nacht der Langen Messer, which they killed about 3,500 people in one night, which was a pretty well orchestrated German efficiency, right? action. And this is also something that we can see, these political mass murders. One of them is shaping up in Meereen. I'm so sure that the Schäfpaid will take Barristan's absence from the city to practically murder all of his political opponents with a brazen beast.
Yeah.
And these political mass murders are horrifying.
Yeah, I think, you know, having... Let me see. I'm going to see how quickly I can get through everything that you just made me think of. I read a book years ago, and I still return to it very frequently from time to time. It's called Fascism, A Very Short Introduction by a professor named Kevin Passmore. I think it's part of an Oxford series of very short introductions to, you know, various historical, political, philosophical belief systems and, you know, historical events and things. It's almost like... if our listeners are familiar with the 33 and a third series of books about great rock and pop albums, it's kind of like that. Anyway, he drew what to me was an extremely illuminating distinction between fascists and conservatives, which is that fascism has a reactionary component to it, you know, which is typically how we think about conservatives, you know, in the Buckley formation, they're standing athwart history yelling stop. So were the fascists to an extent. There were things about modernity that they did not like. But they were also radicals. They were also revolutionaries. There were elements of conservatism that they didn't like. You know, namely, I guess, with the Nazis, the prioritization of capital over the blood and soil. You know, so there were elements that they would have, certainly elements of the... there were parts of the Nazi Party that would have done away with a whole lot more of existing German society than what was actually done. Most of them were concentrated in the SA, who are just like a bunch of like dudes. This was like the bro wing of the Nazi Party. Like they just wanted to get out there and slug it out and fight it out. And, you know, Hitler cracked down on this in the Night of the Long Knives. And I think there's two interesting things about this. When I said interesting. Shit. We have a policy against me saying interesting anymore. So for all of our listeners, I just said it, and I apologize. I'm very, very, very sorry. Anyway, one was that it was viewed with understandable horror by outside observers, because it was the devolution of a modern European civilized nation-state into lawless extrajudicial violence, you know, and which leads to the second thing that was fascinating to me about the Night of the Long Knives, which is that, like, it was basically like a mafia execution. Like, it was like the end of The Godfather when Michael Corleone settles all family business. Because when you read about it, like, you know, obviously everyone involved is awful, but it's just breathtaking. Like, not only did he execute the leaders of the recalcitrant and difficult-to-control SA, he also had tracked down and killed various apostate members of the Nazi Party who had nothing to do with the SA, like Strasser, who was a rival philosophically until he was drummed out of the party. Well, they hunted him down and killed him. They killed the head of the Bavarian state government who helped put down the beer hall putsch, you know, over a decade earlier. They found him and killed him. They killed Hitler's predecessor as chancellor, Stryker, and his wife. They broke into his house and shot them. Yep. Which is like if, you know, a year after Obama was elected, the Secret Service, like, broke into, like, Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas, and fucking shot him and Laura Bush to death. It's so gangster.
Yes.
You know, and that's basically what you were looking at. You know, it was a gangster government.
It just had the powers and the resources of a major industrialized nation.
Yes.
I mean, we see governments and people like Hitler all the time over history and even in our contemporary world. But the thing is, mostly they are governing nations that are really third world nations, destroyed for decades now without the possibility to hurt anyone but their own people, which is really problematic and terrifying enough. But they can start a world war. But Hitler could.
Mm-hmm.
He's just such a strange, guy. He is really not all that typical of German political culture, of Germany itself. He sometimes feels like a foreign influence, but you couldn't put down your finger on where he comes from, what he is, what his appeal was. It is very hard to understand today how this guy could ever become popular.
Yeah, and I think that this leads to the temptation to view him as some sort of historical accident, or like an almost David Lynchian manifestation of evil that comes in from outside. You know, but even there, I'm the one who made the comparison, but Lynch's entities feed and prey on existing human characteristics. That said, I do think that it's important to treat Hitler as historically unique for the reasons I described earlier, because a failure to do so leads to World War II being used as an instructional example of how important and good war is. You know, World War II was worth fighting because Hitler was so unusual. And when Martin creates the Others, whatever their backstory may wind up being, the reason he created the Others was because, to him, this is the only way he could come up with a war actually worth fighting, you know? Like, everything else is kind of sordid and politically compromised and ridden with problems and mistakes and atrocities, you know? Even the most noble of militarily waged campaigns for justice, like Danny's and Marine, for example. I mean, he spent a whole book describing the fallout. Yeah, exactly. So in order to come up with a reason to fight the good fight, he had to literally invent a non-human enemy. And Hitler was a human being, and there's no great mystery about that, but his viewpoint about conflict and about society and humanity was genuinely unusual, even compared to Stalin, as Stefan pointed out earlier. So it's a difficult balance to strike when you think about this stuff, you know, because you don't want to let people, real people, off the hook. You don't want to turn this into some sort of abstract referendum on good versus evil. But at the same time, I think you really need to not extrapolate certain elements of World War II to the level of general principle about the morality of the use of force, because I think it teaches the opposite lesson in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I have a headache, man. This is heavy.
Yeah, it really is. And as you just said, you always have to be difficult to juggle this, that he is on the one hand really an exceptional figure, and on the other hand he is not.
Mm-hmm.
And and this is really difficult and requires that you tread lightly, that you make very careful, deliberate points and not use it as a political argument for the Second Amendment.
Yes.
So we obviously we just scratched the surface here. And if you are interested in these topics, there is a host of things we could point you to. But Sean already mentioned the Hitler biography by Ian Kershaw, which is great, and obviously from an Anglo-Saxon point of view, which makes it perhaps a little bit easier to digest. Then there is from Richard Evans, who is a British historian. He has made a trilogy about the coming of the Third Reich. Is the first book, then the Third Reich in Power, and then the Third Reich at War. Which, if you are interested more in the political stuff, then this is your book. Also in the podcast realm, if you don't listen to him, I want to point you to Dan Carlin, who has this really great podcast, Hardcore History. He has talked about the Ostfront, for example, the Eastern Front, which Sean mentioned in passing as being one of the most horrible places on Earth. Dan Carlin did a multi-hour episode marathon about why the Eastern Front was so horrible. So if you're interested, we will link all of this stuff. Check it out. Mm-hmm. It is really worth your while, but it is not making for a good bedtime story. Unfortunately, the German history in the first half of the 20th century is a big cautionary tale what not to do.
Yeah. And I just have to second what Stefan said, that the it's too important to take these, you know, the stuff is too important to be treated lightly or to be treated brusquely or to be painted with a broad brush, no matter where you're coming from. And so I really think that it's worth examining as closely as possible, being as judicious as possible about the pronouncements you make based on what you learn. Yeah, I can't stress that enough. Amen.
Yeah.
Well, on that light note...
Yes. So now that you're in a good mood...
Yeah. Well, I think that I got a lot out of doing this. I hope... I don't know about you, Stefan, but...
Yeah, definitely.
And I just hope the listeners did as well. You know, I think both of us have always thought that it does well to look at A Song of Ice and Fire in tandem with other artistic and... philosophical and ideological interests, and this is just sort of part of that overall program, I would say, for us. So,
yeah, I mean, just as another added personal note for me, I have professional interest in this topic as well. On the one hand, I am a German, and as a German, you can't escape the history of World War II and the Nazis. They are really everywhere, and this is really the one big topic comparable in impact at best to the Civil War in the US.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just the place it has in popular imagination. And then I am a history teacher, so I have to deal with this stuff day year in, year out, and I have to try to bring it to pupils ranging from, I don't know, 14 to 17, 18, and get them to understand this stuff. So, yes, I have a complicated relationship, I think, to say the least.
Yeah. Well, you know, the harder something is to talk about, the more important it is to talk about,
I think. Yes.
You know, I think you have to lean on the fault lines, you have to lean on the weak spots. When you identify something that makes thinking and living difficult, like, that's what you need to think about the most. So, anyway.
Yeah.
I need a drink again. All right. Well, thank you, Stefan. This was all your idea, and I'm so glad that that you suggested it. And thank you. And thanks everyone for listening, as always.
Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.